So welcome along to a very special last half hour of the Phoenix FM new music show this week. As we approach the end of November, not only do we approach the end of a calendar month, but we approach the end of a charity month and of a movement that has become quite well recognised and well established within society today. So most of you will probably know that November also marks Movember, which is a movement, which is a charity that was set up back in 2003. And the whole idea of the charity is to raise awareness for men's health issues. And this is loads of things ranging from prostate cancer and testicular cancer to also issues in men's mental health, like men's suicide and depression in men. And that is something we're going to focus on for the last half an hour of the show today. And to help us do that, we have a very special guest in the form of James Roast on the show. Now, James is a consultant psychotherapist. He's got 15 years of experience within the profession. He's worked for both the public and private sector in both inpatient and outpatient settings. He currently manages three outpatient clinics at Springfield Hospital in Essex. And if that isn't enough, he also has a great podcast and show here on Phoenix FM called The Happiness Algorithm. James, thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight, mate.
Pleasure to be on the show. Thanks for asking me.
No worries at all. It's great to have you on the show. So did you want to just start off by telling our listeners about the sort of work you do and the patients you see on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, sure. Well, I have a mixed caseload, which means that I treat both adults and children. I have a specialism in child and adolescents. And through the clinic, as I say, I see both children and adults presenting a variety of different mental health conditions. All of my work now is on an outpatient basis, pretty much. Historically, I worked on, or I straddled both inpatient and outpatient settings on a secure unit, but most of my work now is patients that are in the community. Some that may have been discharged from hospital, but are now back at home and working their treatment outside.
So as I said in the intro there, this last half an hour is particularly focusing on the issue of men's mental health. And I just wondered, in your 15 years of experience within the profession, have you noticed any sort of change in the way either men's mental health is perceived or the way it is dealt with, or even maybe the way men come towards you and how forthcoming they are to seek help about their mental health?
Yeah, I think that I would say that is the case, that there has been a significant change. If I think back to when I first trained, it was, well, one, I think there's still, from a professional perspective, in terms of consultant or practitioner role, there's still less men working in the profession than there are women. And I think that also reflects patient load as well. And certainly historically, there was far less men coming in to services. Interestingly, there was a higher proportion of men on inpatient settings, and it makes me wonder whether it was only then, in that position of crisis, that then men, you know, received the help that they did, whereas perhaps women were much more open to asking and seeking out help earlier in their sort of position of need. If we come forward to more recently, like your good self and you know, having segments on the show such as this, we've got the, you know, social media and many good people on various platforms promoting the importance of conversation, speaking about mental health. We've got a generation coming through that are much more inviting of understanding complex emotions. And I think for me, the tide is turning in a very positive way, that, you know, no longer do we see that we need to always find a solution. You know, sometimes emotions will be provoked through circumstance, through situations, and it's okay. And you know, yes, look, from an evolutionary, from an anthropological perspective, we are creatures that want to move away from pain and discomfort, of course. But sometimes it's the acknowledgement of these difficult emotions that enables us to break down a fear that often presents with difficult emotions. So we don't fall into that reactive state. We're being much more responsive. So yes, pleasingly, there's been a shift. We're getting more men willing to open up, to talk about their emotional well-being and their mental health. And this is a good, this is a very, very important thing.
That is definitely good to hear. James, stay where you are. We're going to chat to you some more in a bit, but first let's hear this from Ben Howard. This is Keep Your Head Up.
I spent my time watching the spaces that have grown between us, and I cut my mind on second best, all the scars that come with the greenness, and I gave my eyes to the boredom. Still the seabed wouldn't let me in, and I tried my best to embrace the darkness in which I swim. Now walking back down this mountain, the strength of a turning tide, oh, the wind so soft at my skin, yeah, the sun's so hot upon my side. All looking out at this happiness, I search for between the sheets, or feeling blind, I realize all I was searching for was me. Oh, oh, all I was searching for was me.
That is Ben Howard with a very apt track on Phoenix FM. That is Keep Your Head Up on the New Music Show. And you are listening to a very special last half hour of the show. We are kind of marking the end of Movember and talking about some of the issues that Movember aims to raise awareness for, specifically men's mental health. And I'm joined by James Roast, who is a consultant psychotherapist. He has 15 years of experience within the mental health industry, and he also presents a great podcast and show here on Phoenix called The Happiness bonus algorithm. So my next question for you, James, is there any specific instances or examples of mental health issues which you have found over the years to be more prevalent and more common in the male clients and patients you've worked with, as opposed to the female clients and patients you've worked with?
Well, I think that sadly, the statistics around suicide can't be overlooked, and obviously it is significantly higher in men. And and tragically, those numbers are increasing in women as well. And that's a conversation perhaps for another day. But if I look at, there's a wonderful book called The Essential Difference, and it talks about our genetic makeup as men and women. And one of the opening lines says that what we have to appreciate is that men are hardwired differently to women. And our male brain, if you like, is hardwired to sort of problem solve and fix. It's quite black and white. I always refer to it as it does exactly what it says on the tin. Whereas female brains are multifaceted and layered and obviously are able to sort of, well, multitask without being too cliched and stereotypical. But if we look at the male brain, and I think sometimes what causes males to struggle is that when we look at emotion, they are our emotions are anything other than black and white. They are shades, multiple shades of grey, if you will, and so therefore, when a male runs into difficulties or problems, if they can't find an immediate solution, it creates an internal friction. And that friction, that heat that is generated, can often combust. And then they find themselves in a position of helplessness and hopelessness. It's all too much. It's all too overwhelming. So when we look at suicide, you know, the controversial statements to make are that, you know, believe it or not, we're creatures that do want to live for as long as possible. If we go back to what I said before, we want to live for as long as possible. The only caveat being in as least discomfort. Now, when somebody reaches a point of being completely overwhelmed, obviously, you know, we can't find the solution. We can't find a way to get out of it. So we've distilled our existence in that very moment down to the black and white, the on or off, the hot or cold, the life or death. So often in those instances, for males, it becomes not necessarily a case of choosing death, but it's the brain's infancy saying, I choose, if this is my existence, if this is what my life is, I choose the opposite, I choose the off. And so we end up in that predicament. And I think that, you know, for me, you know, hopefully answering your question, a rather long-winded answer there, but essentially what we've got, the differences, and certainly for males, is this sort of black and white fixated mindset sometimes, which I think as a species we can adjust and we can adapt, and the way we do that is by knowledge, is by understanding, and by talking. If we are communicating, then we're lifting it out of that sort of internal combustion state and giving ourselves the best chance to be understood, listened to, taken seriously, and receive the help that is out there.
So you talk of those physiological differences between men and women in the ways we're wired, I guess. But you also think there's social factors as well which contribute to this, maybe in the way society just is built and the way we have different social pressures and expectations on men which may not be the same within women.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've spoke about it for years, and I don't think that we're diluting it by speaking about it more, but there is this sort of, let's say, macho culture of not embracing emotions, that we don't talk about how we feel as men, and it's a sign of weakness or exposing a level of vulnerability that we're not perhaps comfortable with or we shouldn't adopt. But that has to be that has to be sort of broken down. It has to be broken down. There are qualities, attributes, strengths that we possess as men. There are qualities, strengths, and attributes that women possess as well. And there will be essential differences, as I said before, but when it comes to mental health and our emotional well-being and mental illness, there is a simplicity that can be adopted both sides of the fence, and it has to be sort of inherited and embraced within culture. Sadly, I think culture has a and society still has quite a way to go, but then that's why we have to keep having these conversations.
And what, in your opinion, do you think society can do collectively to help break down those social barriers?
I think that maintaining a level of conversation, I think that, but it's, well, I suppose it's conversation with purpose. You know, we can all communicate and we can all say how we feel, but it's, there are many layers that go with it. So I can tell someone how I feel, but if that person is not effectively attuned to my needs or is not listening, because I think sometimes we fall into the trap of finding solutions. So we're listening, but we're not really hearing what's being said. So I think that what we can do as individuals is we can become better listeners and therefore in turn become better communicators. It normalizes and makes communication much more natural and much more fluid. I think that we can, as a society, begin to adopt a common language at a much earlier age. So speaking with someone this morning, they're doing some wonderful work in primary schools, developing a curriculum about our emotional spectrum and our use of language. So starting children as young as sort of 4 or 5, begin to understand that, you know, what we feel is sometimes complicated, sometimes enjoyable, and lots of other bits in between, and also improve their sort of their repertoire of language. So when we, as adults, well, let me say this. So in the English language, I think there's 499 words that represent an emotion. It's not enough, nowhere near enough, in contrast to what our emotional spectrum is. But equally, we probably use a couple of dozen at best. We say we're anxious, we're sad, we're unhappy, we're happy, we're content. And then we're kind of maxed out a little bit. But when we start to build on that repertoire of language skills, we're then refining that emotional response. Because often, if we look, you know, anger is a very common emotion. It's often seen as an unhealthy emotion. But for me, anger is an incredible emotion, an absolutely incredible emotion that's often underrated and has a bad reputation. But it has a bad reputation because often we suppress anger or it vents in unhealthy ways, that we're not connecting with a set of emotions. We've not refined our emotional response or understood our emotional response as well as we could do. So it bubbles up, bubbles up, bubbles up. And one of the things that anger is, it's a very protective emotion, full of energy. It's a doing emotion. It fights for us, it protects us, it pushes and repels people or things away. But when we peel back that layer, that top layer of anger, then we start to see the emotions underneath, a level of vulnerability, maybe fear, we're scared, terrified, all of these different complex emotions that if as children, we can, with our children, that we can nurture and enable them to understand that these emotions are okay, then they don't feel the need to then project or adopt this protective anger mechanism. And that's, again, what we see a lot with men, is that there's a lot of explosive emotion, a lot of anger, because there's been an avoidance or a disconnect with actually some real complex emotions. I always urge people across the board to kind of go onto a search engine and print off, you know, just put in feeling sheet, and you'll find an A4 sheet of paper with, you know, 200-300 different feelings on, and you start to read through them, and you can't, and you're surprised that how, wow, you know, actually, yeah, I do feel some of these. And when we build on that repertoire of language, actually, that can really help us to understand the ebbs and the flows throughout the day.
That's actually a really, really interesting point you raised there about how can we be expected to seek out help for our mental health when we can't even understand or explain it, as it's almost like beyond our comprehension. And I guess as well, part of the issue is we have so many blanket statements to describe emotions and mental health issues like anxiety, depression, but people's actual feelings and what they feel can vary so much. And one way in which someone may experience a specific mental health issue may vary completely to the way another person experiences it. And I guess that raises the issue as well of treating and tackling these issues. Different things will work for different people. And speaking of that, actually, I hope you don't mind me asking, I just wanted to know how you yourself look after your own mental health and the kind of things that you've found work for you.
Yeah, well, I suppose professionally speaking, a big part of my, well, our practice in the world of psychology is clinical supervision. Now, obviously, speaking to patients, individuals on a daily basis and working with them does fill you up quickly and understandably so. So, you know, it's important for clinical supervision, which enables us to speak about current cases, caseloads, complex circumstances and just to sort of process and put it all into place for us as professional practitioners. But globally speaking, for me it's about managing transitions, so from work to home, from clinic to family time. So recognizing that in these transition points there's opportunity to become much more present in the moment. And that will be through a variety of means. It might be through listening to a podcast, listening to excellent radio shows on a Friday evening. And it will be it will be listening to maybe audio books, breathing exercises, meditation. Now, I've always been, you know, I've understood the importance of meditation for many years now, but it's always been a practice that I've struggled with. But what I will say is I've really found the benefits over the last probably about as little as 6 to 8 weeks. I've always encouraged it, but I've always said it in a way that has been, look, I know that this works, but and I've been honest and said, for me, I can't quite fit it in. As a dad of four children, I have a very, very busy household, and try to find even 5 minutes has often been felt as though it's out of reach. But actually, I'm really getting a lot of benefit from meditation at the minute, breathing exercises. I do love reading as well. Fiction and non-fiction, so that always takes my mind away. And just sort of making sure that we're protecting time to reflect as well, checking in with ourselves. Where am I actually at the minute? You know, we're processing 5 times more information now than we were sort of 30 years ago. As a species, we're struggling to keep up with all of these different demands, externally and internally. This world, the world this year, has been massively bent out of shape. And so we have to find those stop gaps. One of the things I said to someone recently was that, you know, when they banned smoking in the UK, of course it brought about massive huge health benefits, and it was important to do so, but there was actually something that we lost as well. Now, I've not been a smoker, but essentially what I identified that the smoker had or has, maybe if they're still smoking now, is these moments, frequent moments throughout the day where they would excuse themselves from whatever they're doing, go outside, light up their cigarette, smoke it, and that is of course unhealthy. But equally, the healthy side is that in that 5 or 10 minutes that they're having their cigarette, they're just thinking, reflecting. They're in that moment, no demand, no responsibility, and no expectation. Now, this is not me encouraging anybody to take up smoking, but what I'd encourage everybody to do is to go outside multiple times a day for 5 minutes and just think, you know, and we can pick up a 20 a day habit of just thinking. So, and that's what I'm doing through breathing exercises myself as well. And that's how I sort of manage my own well-being.
That's really interesting that you bring up that notion of transitions. Literally only the other day was I reading a post from Barack Obama, of all people, talking about his new book on Instagram. And he spoke about this transition period that he had every single day when he'd walk from his living quarters of the White House to where he would work in his office. And he said he had this walk that would take him about a minute. It was through this sort of outside open garden area. And on the way to work, he would use that minute to think about his day, to think about the challenges he's going to face, to think about the people he'll have to talk to and work with, etc. Then he'll go and do his day. And then on his return walk in the evening, when he has that same minute walk from his office space back to his living space, he has to have that transition again in his head. So he goes from thinking about work to thinking about his family and his dogs and his daughters and maybe what he wants for tea and what he wants to watch on telly that night. And I think if this works for someone with a large scale and demanding job as being the President of the United States, then it's got to work for most people, right? And if he can recognize that importance of having this transition period in your life, then especially at a time when our living lives and our working lives are so close together, that's a lot of people, you know, working in their kitchen and their dining room and their bedroom maybe. So it is really, really important to still possess this transition period, even if that doesn't mean having to sit on a train for half an hour like we would usually do if we were working in an office, or having that car journey home, or having that walk, etc. We could talk about this for hours and hours, honestly, but we've come to the end of the show tonight. James, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your wisdom and sharing your knowledge on the issue. It's greatly, greatly appreciated.
Excellent. Well, listen, look after yourself, keep in touch, and just let me know if there's anything you need.
As I'm sure you're aware, this is a music show, so I can't let you go without at least talking a little bit music. So I would love for you to pick a track for us to end with tonight. Something maybe that you like to chill out to, something that maybe makes you feel relaxed. So James, without further ado, would you please introduce your song choice for us tonight?
Yeah, well, I think that I was introduced to this song by a guest on my show, and it was one that I'd not heard before, which I mean, I was disappointed with myself, really, to be honest with you. It's a band that I know of, but I'd not really sort of, I'd not dipped into their music too much. But this chap that I had on, Joseph, who is a life coach, chose this song, and I played it and listened to it back before the show and was just blown away by the lyrics, and it really sort of hit me. And that was Mumford and Sons, Ghosts That We Know. So yeah, I would go with that one, I think.
You saw my pain washed out in the rain, and broken glass, saw the blood run from my veins. But you saw no fall, no cracks in my heart, and you knelt beside my hope torn apart. But the ghosts that we knew will flicker from view and will live a long life. So give me hope in the darkness that I will see the light, 'cause oh, they gave me such a fright. But I'll hold as long as you like, just promise me we'll be all right. Mm-hmm. and close my eyes to my recent disgrace. 'Cause you know my call, and we'll share my all, and our children come. Hope in the darkness that I will see the light. 'Cause oh, they gave me such a fright. But I will hold as long as you like. Just promise me we'll be alright. From view, and we'll live along.